Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. We're excited to be this week because we're following up with last week's interview with Mitch Iverson with an actual review of all three volumes of the comic series for Voltron Legendary Defender from Lion Forge Comics. And I need my co-host, Greg Tyler. Welcome, Greg.
Oh, it's so good to be needed, Mark Morrell. And of course, we all need you, the host of this podcast and friend and fellow Voltron fan to myself and our many awesome listeners. We're going to talk comics today.
And I can't do a review without you. That's why I need you.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, so last week we chatted with Mitch Iverson, who was the co-writer of the first two volumes and the solo writer of the third volume. And now we're going to talk about the stuff that was written.
Right. Well, let's not forget, Mitch was also one of the staff writers on Voltron Legendary Defender for Netflix.
Yes. Yes, there was that too.
Yes. So we were excited to talk to Mitch, and we talked about the comics a lot, but we really didn't go into the comics in depth, and we're going to do that this time.
Yep.
I'm going to do what I normally do with the episodes. We're going to go through the particulars of each issue. So let's start with Volume 1 from Lion Forge Comics, Voltron Legendary Defender from 2017. The story comes from Tim Hedrick and Mitch Iverson. The art was done by Digital Art Chefs. The lettering is done by And World Design. The cover was done by Mariko Yamashin. And the editor was Ian Brill.
So what did you think about the fact that the artists and the letterers were not identified by name? I was very surprised by that.
Well, if you recall, back when Voltron did a little bit of a crossover comic with Robotech.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that Robotech thing. Yeah.
So Robotech Voltron, do you remember who the artist was for that?
Oh, gosh, no. No, no, no.
Okay. Elmer DeMasso.
Right. Okay. Now it's coming back to me.
Guess who Elmer DeMasso worked for?
Digital Art Chefs?
Yes, Digital Art Chefs.
Okay.
So let's go back in time a little bit. Robotech Voltron, you remember what the art was like in that?
Yeah, now hang on a sec. If we're going to go back in time, we got to go.
Okay, right. So remembering the art that we saw in Robotech Voltron, now remember the art that you saw in Volume 1. Did it seem similar?
It's hard to say because the style of Legendary Defender itself is so different than Robotech and Defender of the Universe. So I don't know. Did it look similar to you?
Well, the other thing is in Robotech Voltron, you were dealing with one artist. In this one, you were dealing with multiple artists called Digital Art Chefs. Hmm. Of course, in Volume 2 and 3, we actually have named artists.
Right, right, right.
So I'm just wondering, did they do a whole collage of artists in the first one and then just go back to a single artist for number 2 and 3?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really get... Now, I am not an expert in comic books. I mean, I used to collect comics a long, long time ago, but I didn't notice huge inconsistencies in the style from issue to issue or page to page. So I had the impression as I was reading it that it had a single cohesive style, maybe drawn by one person all the way through. But, you know, again, I'm not a comic book connoisseur, so I don't know.
And it also seems like the lettering done by And World Design could have been a collaboration of several different letterists.
Yeah, that's possible.
So we don't really know. We just know it was done by a company called End World Design.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, sometimes where the lettering changed, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, your sound effects and versus dialogue and thought balloons and all that. But I don't know that I noticed much in the way of, oh, yeah, and of course, Lance doing his whole thing in issue 3.
Yes, there's some difference there. Yeah. That's what I was thinking of specifically in this volume, the Lance episode.
Yes.
The Tale of Lance and the Dragon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was different lettering style on that one.
Yeah, although I am not a comic book expert. So those of you who are listening who are comic experts, please pardon the fact that my comments are going to sound as ignorant as they really are. Lettering today is far different a practice, I would think, than it was in the pre digital era. I mean, yes, there's definitely, art in kerning and spacing and when to add weight to specific characters and italics and different typefaces. But a lot of the fonts, of course, nowadays are largely digital, or at least that's been my impression, as opposed to the letters being individually written by hand as they were in the old days. But yes, I mean, there's definitely artistry involved in lettering, and certainly issue 3 in volume 1 is a prime example of that.
We did have the same cover artist for all three volumes. So we had Mariko Yamashin on all three volumes. Is that a normal thing for the trade paperbacks?
Again, I don't buy comics or TPBs enough to know. So
Yeah,
all
me
I know is I
neither.
got a kick out of reading them.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we get started? We're going to talk about the general synopsis for this first one. Isn't actually on the volume itself, believe it or not.
Yeah, if you want to call it a synopsis, what's on the back cover of the trade paperback basically just discusses the premise of the TV show and, of course,
Right.
the comics.
So we do get synopsis on both volumes 2 and 3. So the only place that we could find that the synopsis for the comic book was, of course, when it first came out, the publisher, I guess, had provided that as part of the description of the comic book in when it was being sold and everything. So it also came up in the news stories at the time when those came out. So here's the official description for Volume 1. When Team Voltron takes on a dangerous training mission in deep space, Karan, Princess Alora's Major Domo, is captured by an ancient enemy. It will take teamwork, smarts, and of course Voltron to save their friend's life. So that's the basic story.
Yeah, and I have to wonder if in the Star Wars universe, would R2-D2 be C-3PO's Major Domo?
Oh, wow.
Because of the shape of his head, I mean.
That is a major dome he has on there.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so you and I chatted briefly offline before we started recording, and you had made a remark about the use of the term Major Domo here. What were your thoughts?
It's just that in nowhere else do we see Karan referred to as Princess Alora's Major Domo.
Yeah.
He has been considered a protector. I guess he's been considered a
He was called her advisor.
advisor, right?
And of course, he's Karan, the gorgeous man, and the
Right.
Karanic.
But I mean, he was King Alphor's advisor, right?
Yeah, but I think he served in the same capacity with Allura.
Right.
So. Yeah, but yeah, the term major domo seems strange here. In fact, I will tell you, like anybody cares, but I learned a surprising amount of vocabulary as a kid through the Star Wars films, the original trilogy. And the first time I encountered the term major domo was in probably a short story adaptation of Return of the Jedi, because Jabba the Hutt's major domo was the character called Bib Fortuna, who was the character who wasn't really named in the movie itself, but in the merchandising, that was the character's name. It was that the guy who says, he gets mind tricked by Luke saying, I will take you to Jabba now, I'll be rewarded for it, all that other stuff. He was and I guess in the canon of Star Wars, he's a member of the, what do they call them, Twi'lek or Twi'lek species?
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
yeah. So, but yeah, that was the first time I'd ever heard the term major domo. So is that more than you ever wanted to know or what?
Yeah, but if Bib Fortuna was the major domo of Jabba, then what was Salacious Crumb to Jabba?
He was well, I don't know. He was the laugh track.
Was he the comic relief? The
Yeah,
court
maybe.
jester? The one that always laughed?
Yeah. Yeah. So, another bit of background trivia, completely unrelated to the comic here, is that my dad, just to tick me off as a kid, would always refer to Salacious Crumb as hellacious scum. And so there you go. And he always referred to Voltron as Boltron.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and it worked really well. He did get on my nerves with that. But they,
Just to tick you off?
yeah, just to play around over and over
Okay.
and over again. So there you
Okay.
go.
All right. So, can you give me, in your words, a sort sort of a high-level synopsis of this whole volume.
Spoiling the ending or not?
Well, yeah. I mean, I want to get a sense of, you know, we had five issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts at the Fripping Bulgogian and goes all the way down to the Alexian Pearl.
Yeah. So, well, we should, before we jump into this, we should point out that this volume was adapted as motion comics that debuted on YouTube.
Yes.
Yeah, featuring sounds and music and, of course, the vocal talents of people who actually worked on Voltron Legendary Defender, the TV series. So,
yes,
you may already know this story, even if you haven't read the comics. But if I were to summarize this from a 50,000-foot view, I guess I would say Allura is recovering from, I think it's the episode, is it Return to the Balmera?
Yeah.
Where she, from the first season.
Yeah, she healed the Balmera.
Yeah, so this takes place during the span between that episode and Crystal Venom, and she's recovering at the castle after this ordeal, and so Karan takes the opportunity to take the Paladins on a training mission. And the training mission goes south very quickly, at least as far as the Paladins know, because Karan gets captured by that ancient enemy that's mentioned in the synopsis, who basically says, I'm going to let him go if you bring me this thing called the Yalexian Pearl. So that's basically issue one, and then issues 2 through 5 are the Paladins going kind of on a wild goose chase after the Yalexian Pearl, and then in issue 5, they bring it back to that ancient enemy, and there's a twist. And what is that twist, Mark?
Karan wasn't really in any trouble, that it was all a plan for them to save the Krellian people from the Yalex.
Yeah, I mean, the Krell world seemingly had multiple species on it, multiple sentient species, which kind of reminded me of the planet Mongo from Flash Gordon, where, you know, if you follow the mythology, there were all those different races like the Lion Men and the various species that lived on that planet. This sort of reminds me of that, because you got these different groups in different parts of the planet. But yeah, they basically had to save the people of Krell from
the Yalex.
Yeah. Yeah. And getting the Yalexian Pearl was a convenient way to do that and also give the Paladins some training.
So yeah, that was the gist of it. They thought that they were doing it to save Karan, his debt that he owed Cathillion.
Yeah, so the ancient enemy is an old gambling buddy of Karan's named Cathillion Mu, who is still alive after 10,000 years. He's a member of the Mu species, I think that's what it was. But they were very long-lived.
Which and is so, basically like Jabba's family. They were like the mob.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they had to go and get this pearl and satisfy Cathillion Mu so that Karan would be freed. Yeah, and that's just a volume one.
But they went through several battles throughout the course of this volume. They went up against the Guardian, who they killed.
Yeah, that was at the end of issue one, where they kill this horrific creature, and no sooner do they destroy it, but these little insect-like creatures come out and say, what have you done? You've killed our Guardian. And that's the end of issue one.
So they find out that the Guardian was actually protecting them from the Abomination.
Which was another giant, horrific creature.
Yes. Are you getting the we're going to see giant, horrific creatures in these episodes?
Yes. There is a pattern.
Okay. So they go after the Abomination, and it has to do with Hunk's whole thing with Monster Appetite was that Hunk would cook up something that the Abomination would want instead.
Right.
And he did.
Yeah.
He actually did some major cooking in Monster Appetite.
Yeah, he was kind of the head chef, and the Paladins were following his lead, using the lions to make this stew out of stuff.
Yeah.
Let's see, what do they use? Shrubs for stew, but only ones with orangish leaves. Water for the stew, and then it was heated up with Red Lion's flame coming out of the mouth there.
Right.
And the Abomination liked this stuff.
Yeah. So that got them to the point where they were told, okay, now you need to go save a princess, right?
Yeah, because the bug-like little guys, the leader of the village was called Elderbug Blate, and he basically said, I know where the pearl is, but you're going to have to help us out here. And then at the end, oh, yeah, I don't know as, you know, I don't know as much as I had said that I do. You got to go find this princess. She'll know where the pearl is. And so that's basically the end of issue two.
Right. So in issue three, of course, this is all about Lance, because Lance has to go save a princess. So they call it the Tale of Lance and the Dragon. And the reason there's a dragon is because when they first get there, they see this tower. Obviously, it's where you would keep a princess who's being locked up, right? At the top of a tower.
Yeah, it's like Rapunzel, or do a sort of a parody of that, the princess from Shrek, where she was up in that tower, kept by the dragon and all that good stuff. So, yeah.
So, of course, there's a dragon that looks like it's protecting this tower. But do we really know if this dragon is good or bad?
Lance figures it out, because, as we all know, Lance is the brains of the Paladins. And mm-hmm. No, in all honesty, what's fun is that leading up to this, there's a whole bunch of exposition. It's Lance's inner thoughts, and he is imagining, he's basically telling a tale to himself, sort of a sword and sorcery scenario, which is what the Paladins are going through, but he's framing it to the reader and to himself, really, that he's the hero among the Paladins and the amazing, courageous leader. And the other ones are just kind of, you know, coming along for the ride. And he does actually figure out that the dragon itself is the princess.
But he only figures that out because the dragon reminds him of Allura.
Yes. Yeah.
Because when Allura gets angry and yells at him, it sounded just the way the dragon was sounding.
Yeah. Yeah, they had called back to Princess Allura, who in this issue is still recovering, and he was being his flirtatious self, and it, you know, this is back in season one now. Allura didn't take too kindly to his flirtatious words, and acted like she was going to, you know, rip him a new one. And she mentioned something about grabbing him by the Yulstrix or some alien organ. I don't know what that is. Don't know that I want to know. But in any case, yes, that is the precedent that leads Lance to realize that the dragon at the tower is really the princess that they're seeking.
The one thing that gets me is during this volume, they go back to the princess being at the castle ship, and she's with the mice, and she's just having a good old time. She's riding around the castle in a chair or something like that.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a hovering chair.
Yeah. So she's having a good old time.
Yeah, and I really liked this issue in part because of the whole Lance angle, where he's this D&D kind of sword and sorcery hero in his own mind. In a time before we would ever watch Monsters and Mana on the TV show. But I love that we get to see Allura pretty much literally let her hair down. You know, we had Space Mall, where she's, you know, dinner in a show with the space mice and all that, and that was neat. But here we actually see her clowning around a little bit. And it's just neat to see her not being all business all the time for a change.
Yeah, so they figure out that the dragon is the princess, but it's a witch that they actually have to fight, right?
Yeah, so what happened was there's a sorceress or a witch who had cast a spell on the princess that made her into a dragon. And in her dragon form, the princess was guarding the tower because the tower contained the sorceress. So basically what happens is they realize that the princess is a dragon, and then the sorceress attacks them. And when the sorceress attacks them, she's actually a pretty formidable threat for the lions, until Pidge cloaks the green lion and then basically pins down the sorceress with one of the lion's paws.
That's right.
Yeah, and then in doing that, the curse on the princess is lifted and the dragon reverts to her normal princessly form.
Right.
Yeah, then it turns out she doesn't know
where the Alexian pearl is.
Yeah, so she tells them that the wisest among them, Pidge, has to face the riddle of the Sphinx.
Right.
And that's basically where issue three leaves off.
Yes. And then, of course, issue four is all about this riddle. And the Sphinx looks sort of like the Sphinx a little bit from like the Egyptian pyramids, right?
Yeah, and it actually shows up. Its initial form is a giant ziggurat, yeah, which looks very inspired by ancient Egypt, and of course the Sphinx form does too.
Right.
But it's sort of revealed in this issue, or there are claims in this issue from the great universal Sphinx that it had visited Earth and influenced the development of humanity to some extent. So, if what the Sphinx is saying is true, and who knows if it is in this fictional continuity, maybe ancient Egypt had been the culture of ancient Egypt had been influenced by this creature from some past visit.
Right. So it is decided by this Sphinx that the most knowledgeable amongst them, which turns out to be Pidge,
Surprise!
has to go through tests of body, mind, and spirit. And if she proves herself, she would be able to help save her friend Karan and get the Yelexian Pearl. But the first thing that he does is he puts all this stuff on each of the other four
Yeah,
paladins,
each of them gets this like a spore, a mushroom or something.
on their foreheads or something like that, and they're actually sort of controlling each of the paladins.
Yeah, this is the Great Universal Sphinx's version of mind swishing, like the mermaids.
So the first thing she has to do is fight her friends, and in doing so, they fight exactly as they would fight. So what we find out about Pidge is that she really keeps data on all of her friends, sort of like the same way that Batman keeps all of the weaknesses of all the Justice League members, and he knows a way to defeat each and every one of them.
And so Pidge has thoughts about that too.
So Pidge knows what their weaknesses are, what their fighting styles are, and everything, and she's able to use that information to defeat them,
Yes.
each and every one of them.
And so what's really interesting here is that we learn we peek into Pidge's mind through these blocks of text that are written like an old school monochrome computer screen or terminal. And it sort of, weighs into the notion that Pidge has a very rational and logical computer-like brain. And what's fun is that the very last paladin that she faces in battle is Shiro, and she basically summarizes that Shiro has no weaknesses on file. I mean, she does mention that he's got these debilitating flashbacks, but she didn't know how to exploit them. She wound up hacking his cybernetic hand and helped defeat him in combat that way. But I like the fact that her initial assessment is that Shiro has no weaknesses, which is pretty cool.
Right. Well, her second test then is basically chess. But she decides to use her friends as the pieces.
Because what happened is, number one, why is it chess? The Sphinx claims that it, brought chess to Earth. And again, is that true? But, because a lot of what the Sphinx says toward the end of the issue seems to be greatly exaggerated. But the Sphinx uses another one of those spores, but in this case, to copy Pidge's brain, or what she knows. And so Pidge has to play the game against this spore, effectively herself. And so she uses her fellow paladins to help her face off against herself.
Right. And she ends up getting checkmate. So, way to go, Pidge.
Yes.
And then, of course, they go to the most difficult challenge of all, the riddle. And the riddle is, what can be totally broken apart and yet reform stronger than ever? And Pidge answers, it's Voltron. And then the Sphinx says, no, the correct answer was hope. And she argues with him about it.
And he's really, really petty about it too.
Oh, yeah.
He's like a little kid when, nope, this is the answer. Or, I mean, he literally says, Pidge says Voltron. The Sphinx says, incorrect, you have failed. Pidge says, what? Then what is it? Hope. The correct answer was hope. But Voltron is applicable and very relevant. I'm sorry, but the answer was hope. And now I will never tell you where the pearl is.
Right. And they all try to convince him as to why Pidge's answer should be honored, and he says, well, that's not how it works. I make the rules, and I'm not helping you at all. Now get in your lions and leave, right? And that's it. Pidge has had it, all right? She's gone through all these tests and everything. Oh, you want to test my spirit? Oh, let's do it, right? So they all get in their lions, and she goes, mind if I say it, Shiro? And he goes, go for it. And she says, form Voltron. So Pidge gets to say it.
Yeah, which is cool.
Yeah.
And so they have their little fight, and ultimately Voltron pins down the Sphinx, and keeping in mind that the Sphinx is another one of those gigantic, horrible creatures. And in this case, Voltron pins down the Sphinx. The Sphinx says, okay, okay. And basically it says, oh, here are the words right here. I'm sorry. I know it was a horrible riddle. I just do that so people can't answer correctly. I do it to make myself feel superior. It's pathetic, really. And it says, I'll say. And then the Sphinx says, hey, I saw in your mind. Do we really want to get into who's more pathetic than whom? Then Lan says, never mind. But, yeah.
So he says the pearl is in the ever shadow of our moon, but it's a dangerous place and darkness lurks below. So now they've got to go to the ever shadow of the moon.
Yes. So hopefully, for the sake of the Paladins, this will be where the Galex is. And of course, because of story flow, this is the end of issue 4 of a 5-issue volume. So chances are pretty good that they're going to find the pearl in the next issue.
Right. So this is where they get to the ever shadow of the moon. I guess the people of Krell say, have you come for the Galex?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, yes, do you know where it is and what it is? And the person says, yes, where, what, and when. What?
Yeah, they're called the high priests of the temple of the Galex.
So this is a temple.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has something to do with they have grain, they dry it, masticate it, and preserve it in the cuspidors.
Mm-hmm.
And then they carry them to the eye of the Evershadow and pour them in. And is that how the Alexian pearl is developed?
Don't know, really.
Because they want to know, is that the pearl?
Mm-hmm.
The guy says yes. He says the pearl, the moon, the eye, time, life, all are the circle. Never ending, never broken.
In other words, they're speaking like high priests of the temple of the Alex.
Right.
Very confusingly.
They follow the ways of the Haruspex. Whatever that is.
Yes. Yes, whatever that is. You know, if you can figure that out, you too can follow the ways of the Haruspex.
Okay, so apparently the Galex is the end of days.
Yeah, well, it's called a lot of things, but that's one of them, yes.
Right. So when they're saying, and what about the pearl? And he says, the Galex is the pearl. The pearl of wisdom that comes at the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the Galex is the creator and destroyer, treasure and terror, redeemer and annihilator, savior and executioner. One is all. The fire in the dark, the eye that is blind is most prized.
Yeah.
So when the name of the episode is the inner eye, it's really the middle eye of this Galex monster.
Yeah, so the reveal is that this entire moon is basically an egg.
Well, when you put it that way.
Right? I mean, did I spoil it too soon?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's okay.
Okay.
That's
all right.
They go through some big battle thing, and then the egg opens up, right?
Yes, and there's the Galex inside.
And there's the Alexian pearl.
Yes, it is the middle eye, as you said, of the Galex creature. That's why I jumped into the whole thing about the creature, yes.
Right.
But yeah, so they obtain the pearl, destroying the Galex in the process, and they take it back to Cathelion Mu, the character, the ancient enemy that was referenced in issue 1. And lo and behold, what do the Paladins learn?
That was their training mission.
Yes. Yeah, and so Keith says, that whole thing was a training mission. Pidge says, we nearly got killed. Karan says, you didn't have any fun? Last time we did this, Alfor got into some kind of board game with a lion thingy. He never stopped talking about it. Lance, you didn't meet any girls? And Lance says, well, a paladin never tells.
Yeah.
Karan basically says, that was just to motivate you, the whole thing about Karan being in danger. But Krell was in danger from the Yaleks, and we knew Voltron was the only thing that could possibly stop it. And now Cathalion can sell the Pearl and use the Gak to fight Zarkon. And then Hunk says, can we not have any more training for a while? That was exhausting. And then Shiro says, I think we've trained enough. It's time we got back to fighting Zarkon. And Hunk says, ah, perfect. So what did you think of Volume 1 in total?
Oh, well, I wanted to go back to frippin' Bulgogian, you know. I thought it was pretty cool that there was a table there that had been used by the original paladins.
Yeah, they had actually had their names inscribed on the table, which was really cool.
Yeah, and of course it's a Nunvillery.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like a nice place to be, but obviously they ran into places around the galaxy that were much worse.
Right. And I liked Volume 1 a lot. I think it was very clever how they created a standalone story and still referenced the surrounding episodes, or at least the preceding episode, in such a way that you knew where it fit in. But by making this whole thing effectively a training mission while Allura recovers from having healed the Balmera, I think it works really well. I like the fact that it wasn't so tightly coupled with the continuing story of the show that you felt like you needed to have seen the show to understand what was going on in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that it was standalone. And frankly, I loved that they formed Voltron in every single issue.
Oh, yeah. And they fought a lot of monsters. Lots of monsters. But we're going to see that in all three volumes.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, Pidge got to form Voltron the one time.
Yeah. It was cool. And you know, if you're an old school Voltron fan, then you're very accustomed to Voltron being formed in just about every single episode or story and dealing with one Robeast or another. And this is kind of a fun tip of the hat to the 80s show while still being very faithful in character and spirit and, of course, visual design to Voltron Legendary Defender.
And, of course, like we said before, the Yaleksian Pearl is referenced in Monsters and Mana.
Yep.
It not only takes place at a point relative to the show, but then later, in later seasons, it gets referenced back from the comic book.
Yeah, that actually is really slick.
Yeah. All in all, of course, this was the only one that got the motion comic, too.
Right, right.
So that made it special all on its own.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is because the comic, as Mitch Iverson alluded to in the previous podcast, it allowed DreamWorks to continue to promote the show when there was nothing new coming out between seasons.
Right.
Because even Volume 1 came out relatively late in the making of the series. They pretty much wrapped much of the production work of the show by the time Volume 2 could potentially have been made as a motion comic. And the promotional value of making motion comics would have diminished because we would have been in later seasons and just about everyone who would have started watching the show would have already done so by that point. Financially, it probably didn't make good sense to consider doing volumes 2 or 3 as motion comics.
Yeah. Okay. That completes volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to move on to volume 2, Lion Forge Comics, Voltron Legendary Defender Comics, volume 2, Pilgrimage, which was actually published in 2018. The story was by, again, Tim Hedrick and Mitch Iverson. This time, issue 1 art was done by Jung Guan Yu. The colorist for issue 1 was Ji In Choi. And issues 2 through 5, the art was done by Rubin. And the colorist was Benny Lobel. The lettering was still done by End World Design, and the cover by Mariko Yamashin. The editor in this one was Bethany Bryan. So the description that we see on the back of the book here is, the Dav Dabao are an alien race far from home and facing an uncertain future. For their survival, they need to reach their sacred hunting grounds and establish a new life there. But the journey is dangerous and they'll need help from Voltron.
Woohoo!
So we spend basically the whole volume with the Dav Dabao.
Yeah, and that's kind of unique in and of itself.
They're a clan of legendary hunters and shamans.
And in the Voltron Legendary Defender TV program, we had a few episodes from season one that took place on the Balmera, and had therefore we saw the Balmerans in a few episodes. This is that's probably the closest that Voltron Legendary Defender, the program, got to volume two of the comic, because we have the same characters of the same species throughout all five issues, which is kind of neat.
Right. We do have, and I do want to mention this, in that first issue, we had each of the chapters had their own name, and we had mentioned those. In this one, the chapters have their names too. So in chapter one, we talk about hunting grounds. In chapter two, it's the wastes. In chapter three, it's the Gantamore Nebula. In chapter four, it's Fields of Sorrow. And in chapter five, Baby Back. So we start off at the hunting grounds, and we see these flying katkas. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, KOTKA. They look almost like alien flying dinosaurs or something. The Davdabal ride on them.
Right. And this is how they do their hunting, right? So when the Voltron crew meets them, what's going on?
They're being attacked by the Galra.
And do we know any of the Galra in this one? Is it anybody we're familiar with?
I did not recognize that particular Galra commander, no.
No.
But I will say that there's a bit of backstory that we probably ought to have mentioned here leading up to issue one. I'm going to read a very quick introductory blurb from the
Okay.
beginning.
Yeah, go
It
ahead.
says, "The Paladins of Voltron have just learned of the existence of the Blade of Marmora, a secret society of Galra soldiers who have sworn to bring down Zarkon's evil empire from the inside. Keith now realizes that he may have links to the group. Perhaps Galra blood even pumps through his veins. And while our heroes want nothing more than to find allies to aid them in their fight for galactic justice, they fear that going to the Blade of Marmora headquarters will only lead Zarkon's forces to its hidden location. Because somehow, Zarkon has been tracking their every move. With so much on their minds and the very fate of the universe hanging in the balance, there's only one thing for the Paladins to do." And it opens with them playing around on the training deck of the Castle of Alliance. And then they're interrupted, and they go and they help the Davdabal against the Galra.
Right. It's based on the fact that they hear a distress signal.
Yes, and so this plants this story sometime fairly early in season two.
Right. Because we already knew Keith could have Galra blood. So again, it ties right at the beginning to the TV show. But you never know that based on what happens in the actual issues, right? They never refer to what's going on in the TV show at all.
They actually do issue one. I think there's a brief mention of them thinking about going to the headquarters of the Blade of Marmora.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember exactly where that is, but I think they do briefly mention it, not just in that introductory bit that I read.
Okay.
But anyway.
So when they initially meet with the Davdabal, the one who is their leader, I guess his name is Baruch. He says, "Paladins of Voltron, Illac prophesied that I would one day see your lines, but I admit I thought she had burned too much hinterbush. I am Baruch. We thought the Yeltaeans dead as soon as it seems our people will be." And then Allura says, "I'm Princess Allura, and this is Corran, and we're the only two Altaians remaining." And of course, we know that's not true anymore, right?
Right, but at this point in the narrative, not even Allura and Corran knew that. But yeah.
So while they're talking, another wave of attacks come from.
Galra.
Yeah. So there's Galra sentries and all kinds of things attacking them. So they fight them off, and during the battle, Baruch gets killed. So Baruch is actually the father of two daughters. Coover and Collar.
It's KUVYR. I just in my head I thought Kuvir, but who knows? And then KALAR, I thought of that as Kalar simply because there is an alien, or yeah, there's an alien in Star Trek that was called Kalar and spelled that way. But, you know, hey.
Okay, so Kuvir and Kalar. And the funny thing is, based on the fact that their father passed away and everything, they want to both marry Hunk.
Yes, because if you'll pardon the expression, size does matter.
He is the biggest paladin.
That's right. So they gravitate, not literally, to him and want to marry him.
Let's just say it's about size and strength.
That's right. That's right. And so because Baruk is dead and because they want a new chief or whatever you want to call it, they're drawn to Hunk. And they've also asked the paladins to help them find their sacred hunting grounds. So they had been on some planet hunting and living fairly well until the Galra came along. And now they're asking the paladins to help them relocate to another world where their sacred hunting grounds and their future new home will be.
Yeah. Before they get there, though, Lance has to give his love lessons to Hunk.
Yes. And that happens in issue two. Yeah, Hunk is trying to deal with the fact that he has these two people who want to marry him. And yeah, so he naturally, if you need advice about love, go to Lance. Lover boy Lance.
Yeah. We also find out that there's this thing called the Mangadni.
Yeah. Pronounce it however you want, but the first five letters are manga.
Yeah.
So I thought it was like Mangadni or something, but basically they find this thing in space.
Yes, a big giant monster out in space, of course, because that always happens to them.
Yes, and this creature is so large that it has a very noticeable gravitational force.
Okay, can you expound on that a little bit?
It weighs on them very greatly. No, but basically, don't they find it because of a gravitational distortion or something?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, basically this gigantic monster, bam, there it is. The lions are launched from the Castle of Lions. They form Voltron, and Pidge remarks, it's so massive that its gravity is affecting our instruments.
Right.
And according to Ilak of the Davdaval, it's a manga adni, you know, pronounce it however you want. They breathe electricity and destroy worlds.
And the Davdaval at one point even frees it, and they're about to give it the final blow, but then Hunk realizes something.
It's a baby.
That it was crying.
Yeah.
And it may actually be looking for its mother.
Yep.
He says, I think this monster is a baby and the bigger one is its mom, and I think we need to bring the baby to its mom.
Yes.
So with that in mind, they lead this monster to the bigger Mangadni.
Mm-hmm.
However you pronounce it. And in doing so, it works.
Yeah. Mommy's happy, baby's happy, the paladins live.
And they're able to translate a message that says, thank you for returning my child.
Yep.
This even makes the daughters of Baruk even like Hunk even more.
Yes.
Because now his sensitivity and nurturing nature has awoken something in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I got to tell you, before we jump out of issue two, we're not done talking about it, but if you like Lance, and who doesn't, there's one page in this comic that makes this issue totally worth it for major Lance fans. And that is, as we mentioned a little while ago, Hunk goes to Lance for advice about love. And there's a full page spread. It's called Lance's Guide to Falling in Love.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious.
Yeah.
It does have off to the side Lance's five best pickup lines, but we'll leave that for readers to check out and enjoy.
Yeah. I think they've gone through Lance's favorite pickup lines many times in many different forms of media.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're in print for all to enjoy.
Okay. So we find out that the Wastes were just like the first step in their challenges that they're going to have to go through here to find the sacred hunting grounds, right?
Yes.
So we go into the next issue, and at the beginning of this issue, Karan is looking through Alfor's lab.
Yeah, within the Castle of Lions, there's this chamber which we've never seen before in the show.
Right.
And this is something I really like about the comic. When you get these little peeks into additional areas or areas of the mind, even with Pidge and her dossiers of the Paladins, this is a fun little tidbit that you never get in the show. Alfor had in the Castle of Lions a lab where, among the various bits of equipment, he had also hoarded a bunch of the stuff that they had found during their adventures as Paladins.
His souvenirs.
Yeah.
So whenever they would travel to a new planet or weird space hole, Alfor would scrounge around and pick up some rock droppings, some netting, and other assorted stuff. So one thing that happens is while he's in there, he knocks over something and it crashes and breaks, and he doesn't realize it at the time, but he develops a virus.
Yes, he gets sick. It's a sample of something that is later called nomovirus,
Right.
which is kind of a fun play on a real and actually dangerous thing called the norovirus. But I wonder if there's a pun here that it's nomovirus, no more virus. I don't
Right.
know.
So meanwhile, the rest of them are looking out into space and they see some kind of a nebula that looks like the face of something, and it quickly disappears.
Right.
Keith says, I'm just going to go into the training room and train for a while. And he ends up running into this warrior called Gantamore, who's the warden of the sacred hunting grounds of Dabdabal.
Yeah, so Gantamore is a Dabdabal himself, and he claims to be, yes, a guardian or protector of the sacred hunting grounds.
But he's not just training, he's challenging Keith to a fight to the death.
Yes.
Of course, right?
And he's fighting with a sword,
Right.
like Keith's Bayard sword.
Yes. So, what ends up happening in that battle?
They're fighting, and the paladins arrive to help Keith. And then.
It basically says, "Sorry, Wolfie, but you mess with one of the paladins, you get the whole Voltron."
Yes, and so then Gantamore leaves, preparing to face Voltron.
Right. In that process, we see that Karan looks obviously worse from the nomovirus, and the paladins go to now to fight this gigantic Gantamore nebula.
They form Voltron. Gantamore becomes really, really big, like Voltron.
Right.
So there's a pattern here. Gantamore was fighting as a human, roughly human-sized Dabdabal with a sword, like Keith's Bayar sword. The Paladins launch the lines and form Voltron. Gantamore now faces them in a roughly equally sized, gigantic, horrific creature.
But what ends up happening is he's firing back exactly what they fire at him. So then they say, "So what do we do? Just stop shooting?" They're dealing with that. At the same time, Karan is figuring out what's going on with this virus and everything. But then they're realizing that Gantamore may be too powerful. And how can you defeat an enemy who can transform himself from man to a giant to an army? And he just keeps on firing back what you fire at him. So if you give him more and more, he's given more and more back.
Right. And then Karan has an idea.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is he ends up showing up on one of those Katkas dressed in his outfit that he tried to win over Red Lion with, the big cape, the visor with the V coming out with his mustache and just that whole outfit.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that chronologically speaking, if this fits in season two, this is actually the first time we've seen this chronologically, even though volume two of the comic came out after we saw it in the TV show.
Right.
So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. When the Gantamore Nebula sees this little warrior who rides a Katka to battle him, he says, "I'm Karan, leader of the Altaians. I lead an army of multitudes who seek to battle with you." So he sees it as another foe to overcome, and he welcomes the fight. What does Karan do? But he sneezes on him. And that ends up giving him, a virus that has millions, billions, trillions of little creatures aggressively taking over the nebula.
Yes, and so Gantamore, just as it had morphed itself to face Keith, it morphed itself again to face Voltron. It now splits itself apart into billions and billions of itty bitty little thingies to fight the individual virus bits. And the castle's able, the castle and the Dabdabal and the lions are able to move on.
Yeah, so it was Coran that saved the day, and of course his virus goes away and he's feeling better. And that's basically how it ends.
Yeah, so one thing that we pointed out to Mitch, and of course he knew because he helped write this comic, is that Coran is in space for this whole scene, riding a Kottka, which, as far as we know, I mean, we've seen them actually flying in space earlier in the story. They have wings, they're flying in space. Okay, hey, it is what it is. And he has no life support equipment on. He's talking in space, then he sneezes in space, and he is none the worse for wear. In fact, being in the vacuum, as you mentioned, cures him of this virus. So Coran is quite amazing. He's not just Coran Coran, the gorgeous man. He's Coran Coran, the can talk and sneeze and seemingly hold his breath or even breathe in space, man.
Yeah.
So there you go. He may be a chosen Altaian for entirely different reasons than Allura was.
Oh, sure.
There you go.
Absolutely.
That's right.
We start the next issue, and Hunk is moving some things around, and he finds this big egg, and then it opens up, and it's a creature. It looks like one of those baby Kottkas. So he gives the creature a name.
Herschel.
Yes.
And Herschel is seemingly named after a deceased pappy of Hunk's.
Right.
And in the real world, Herschel is the last name of obviously a lot of real world people. One of them is Frederick William Herschel, who was a well-known astronomer from the 1700s and 1800s. So that may be a tip of the hat to Herschel. I mean, sometimes Voltron does have some real science baked into the science fantasy. And so Herschel might have just been a fun tip of the hat there.
Okay. Herschel is another part of the story, but they have the continuing story, and part of that was once they got past Gantamore, they were on their way to the Promised Lands. So the Promised Lands lie just beyond the Fields of Sorrow, and it's the longest leg of the journey. And of course, the myths say that plague, sadness, and death fill the fields. Because nothing's ever easy.
No, of course not.
These are the Fields of Sorrow.
That's right. It's not going to be all fun and games.
So they get to there, and it looks like a basic an asteroid field, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Herschel sees the mice, and he ends up chasing the mice, and Allura gets really upset at Herschel about that.
Yeah.
But in the process, the Paladins are called into action. I guess Herschel ends up being in the cockpit with Hunk, doesn't he?
Yes, it's kind of like Allura with Cosmo. Remember when they were kind of switching places in their lines, who rides with whom, as they were going back to Earth in season 7 of the show? Except at this point, Herschel is in the cockpit, as you mentioned, with Hunk, as opposed to Cosmo being in the cargo bay or whatever of the Blue Lion. So
Right.
Herschel seems to find the cockpit kind of tasty.
And he becomes a big distraction for Hunk.
Right.
So they're fighting what looks like a plague of locusts out in space.
Yep.
So there's too many of them, and they need to fight them and everything. So they end up forming Voltron once more.
That's right. Yet again.
They say it's like trying to move sauce with a sieve. They're not actually doing anything. So then the Dabdabao actually jump into the fray with their Kottkas and everything, and they assist in the battle. And at one point they want Hunk to fire the cannon, and he can't because he's says that Herschel's chewing into the life support system. They need another strategy, and Allura says that she'll make a wormhole to their promised lands. And Coran thinks that'll be too difficult, but she says she has to try. She sets up the wormhole, and what happens?
Allura opens a wormhole. There are a bunch of Dabdabal ships outside the Castle of Lions, helping to fight those locusts and all that stuff. And Allura can't keep the wormhole open long enough. And so Voltron basically throws a bunch of the Dabdabal ships into the wormhole. And then they all fly in after it. So the castle and Voltron fly in after it. And then they arrive at the Promised Lands.
Right. And they find that those planets are orbiting a micro black hole.
Yes. I mean, all black holes are kind of small, supposedly. But yeah.
But this isn't black. This is a light.
Yeah.
And the light's emanating from the accretion disk burning off nearby gas, so not all black holes are supposed to be black, apparently.
There you go.
They arrive on this planet, and this is supposedly the Promised Land, right?
Yep. There are Dabdabal on this planet, and they summon their king, King Babar, and he's so giant, so strong-looking, that he falls in love with the two daughters of Baruch. They fall in love with him, and he walks away with them. So Hunk gets off the hook. He doesn't have to marry either of them. And, oh, by the way, Herschel bonds with the king as well.
That's right.
Yeah, Hunk loses his suitors and loses his destructive animal.
All in one swoop.
Yes, and then just then the Galra arrive too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
To be continued.
And yes. Then this is, of course, leading us into issue 5.
Yes. And this is basically an action issue. I mean, it's Voltron and the Kotka-mounted Dabdabal fighting the Galra.
So the reason that the Galra are there is because basically Voltron has already destroyed or distracted everything that was guarding the past. So the Galra are able to attack the Dabdabal again because of Voltron.
Yeah.
Okay. So then they, of course, battle against the Galra. They get to their ships.
Basically, they're having trouble getting to the Galra command ship. And so the healer or shaman among the original Dabdabal, Ilak, she summons the baby manga something-something from issue, was it 2? And it shows up and its yells basically destroy the Galra fleet.
Yes.
So, you know, you think it's bad when you're on an airplane
uh-huh.
and you hear a baby crying on a really long flight.
Right.
That's nothing compared to what the Galra went through here.
Okay.
And that's basically it. And at the end of the show, at the end of issue 5 and the end of volume 2, the Castle of Lions Teladov has been fully restored and they're ready to fight Zarkon again. So they were sort of taking a bit of a breather from being chased by Zarkon's bunch, although they were chased by the Galra in this storyline, and now they're ready to fight Zarkon again. So we're back to the normal remainder of season 2 of the show.
And the Teladav is fully operational.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, so let's go into volume 3.
So what'd you think of volume 2 before we jump into volume 3?
Okay. I don't know. I had a harder time keeping up with everything that was going on in volume 2 versus volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of animals, okay? So the Dabdabal, the monsters and everything, and Herschel and all these things, the Kotkas, and yeah, just a lot of things that I had to keep track of that I wasn't prepared for.
Yeah, I think my only gripe with Volume 2, I genuinely enjoyed it. I like the fact that our heroes were helping out a single group of people for an extended period of time. It wasn't just they fly in to save the day and then leave.
Right.
I like that a lot. And of course, I like them forming Voltron because, you know, I like Voltron. But the only gripes that I have, and this is where I get a little bit weird, where, you know, I can accept that someone can sit inside the head of a robot lion and pull two sticks and somehow control that lion effectively. And when they all form a robot, I can accept that 5 people sitting in 5 different places in the robot can control the robot effectively with their pair of sticks. But when you start making sounds and breathing in space and you can't write it off as dramatic license, you know, as Karan does here, where he talks and sneezes in space. And as I really did like the manga something something baby and mom and all that stuff, but crying in space and sounds in space when it is a legit part of the story, as opposed to a sound effect that you can sort of brush off as something to, you know, make it sound more dramatic or whatever in a show.
Right.
That bugged me a little bit. And I know that in this fantastical world, it probably shouldn't bother me, but it did a little.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's about it. It's like in Star Wars Episode II when Jango Fett is shooting, he's chasing after Obi-Wan in mm-hmm. the Jedi Starfighter, and he launches a weapon that is called a sonic charge in space.
Yeah.
And it is the sonic energy that is shattering all these asteroids. And again, if we're just cool sounds, and we could just say, you know, that just makes it more dramatic and fun to watch and listen to, that's one thing. But they literally call it a sonic weapon in space. And then my brain goes, eh. I could take Jedi, but sound in space, no. but I had a similar reaction here. I mean, I enjoyed Volume 2. I thought it was fun. I liked the two daughters of Baruch being interested in Hunk and all that stuff. And that was a fun sort of side story. But sound in space, nah.
Yeah. Okay. So now we go to Volume 3. And it's from Lionforge Comics, Voltron Legendary Defender, Volume 3, Absolution, it's called. And this is published in 2019. The story is by Mitch Iverson alone.
Mm-hmm.
It is illustrated by Rubin alone. Colored by Benny Lobel. Lettered by End World Design. And the cover is again by Mariko Yamashin. So, in this one, there's no names on the chapters at all.
Yeah.
So it's just chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and chapter 5.
Yep.
So I don't know why we didn't keep with naming the chapters.
I don't know. Maybe that was a Tim Hedrick thing when he was co-writing. I don't know. But we do have a synopsis.
Yes. So the five paladins of Voltron are back and ready to continue their mission to defeat the Galra Empire and bring peace to the galaxy. But peace doesn't come easily, as their new mission takes them out of the cockpit, where they will be forced to depend on their wits and skills beyond forming Voltron. Each of our heroes will play a pivotal role as they struggle to infiltrate a Galra supply chain of imprisoned planets known as the Sprawl. If they succeed, they'll strike a critical blow to the evil Empire of Oppression. But if they fail, our paladins and the inhabitants of an entire galaxy will be lost forever.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wow.
There is information that these paladins are acting on throughout Volume 3. And they make a big deal about how important this information is by putting the word information in bold everywhere you see it referenced in the comic.
Yeah, that's true.
And we learn where the information comes from at the very end of the volume.
Right. So we won't give that away right now.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So do they in any way tie this volume into any part of the TV show?
Yes. I did not figure out exactly where it fits in, but they mentioned the Voltron show in the past tense. So they've already done that. Keith is nowhere to be found in Volume 3 because he is off doing Blade of Marmora stuff. So it's the Paladins minus Keith. So we've got, you know, Shiro and Lance and Pidge and Allura and Hunk. And so we are, that positions us where in the narrative?
That was like Season 4, wasn't it?
I think so. So when was The Prisoner? Was The Prisoner the first episode of Season?
Plus the other thing is we get Matt in this as one of the rebels.
Right. Okay, so this entire volume, for reasons we haven't gotten into, takes place between seasons 4 and 5.
Okay.
And that's all we can say about it at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we start at a place I don't think we've ever been, planet Pinto Centos?
Yeah, we've never been there.
Is this somebody that the Coalition is trying to help?
The Paladins are basically trying to rescue this planet. There are a bunch of Galra ships, and they're trying to help free these planets without scattering the Galra ships in that region to other planets that have already been liberated from the Galra.
Right. they find out that the leader of this is Dutarn?
Dutarn. Yeah, something like that.
Okay. But they also find out that Dutarn is at planet Grekagon.
Mm-hmm.
And he also has his own, like, TV show?
Yes, he is a TV star. He has a show called Dutarn Fixes Grekagon.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, so the Voltron show ain't the only show in the universe.
Right. But we do get to meet the Bebo Bee in this one, right?
Yes, and this is, in fact, Bebo Bee from the Voltron show and other episodes. Yes, that very character.
So while Dutarn is talking to Karan and Allura, what they don't realize is they're actually on his show at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So Allura gets kind of tired of that pretty quickly.
Yeah, because basically the Paladins are able to free Pinto Centos from the Galra using the information in Bold. And they go to this planet, Grekagon, trying to get some help to send aid to Pinto Centos. It's just been liberated, but its people need help. And the leader, Dutarn, basically tells them that they're not going to help. They've got to worry about themselves. And, oh, by the way, they're on TV, and it's really annoying.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the other four Paladins are out in space, and they're getting caught in some kind of cosmic storm.
Yeah.
This is the part that bothers me. They keep on going back and forth between what the other four Paladins are doing and what Allura and Karan are doing with Dutarn.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps on going back and forth. At one point, Allura thinks she's failed as a leader and her father would be disappointed in her.
Allura and Karan are trying to get help from Dutarn, the leader of Grekagon, to help the people of Pinto Centos. Dutarn's only worried about the ratings of this show, and so he doesn't care about what's going on. And the people of his planet and neighboring worlds are fixated on this show, so they're not going to help out either. So what happens in parallel with this is that Voltron is working itself silly, trying to save a group of people from these space storms. And it's fighting valiantly and doing everything that it can, but they need help. And the people on this planet need help. And what saves the day here is that Karan and Bebo Bee in particular, has been filming Voltron being all heroic. And it turns out that the people who would normally be watching Dutarn's show watch this broadcast of Voltron being a hero, and it inspires these various beings to come to the aid of this planet.
Right.
And that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At one point, Karan asked Bebo Bee, how many people are watching? And Bebo Bee just goes, Bo! And Karan goes, that's incredible!
Yeah. So that's the deal. And so with the help of these people who have been inspired, who have been shaken from their apathy from TV, they've been inspired by TV to help these people out. And that gives Allura some inspiration to use some of that information that they've obtained in bold print, basically to free people who are captured by the Galra and forced to work in this region called Sprawl, where there are a bunch of planets that are being harvested by the Galra for raw materials to build Galra cruisers. And so they basically have been inspired to, you know, because this information they used helped them to free Pinto Centos. They're now going to go to the Sprawl and try to free a bunch of people and slow the production of Galra ships.
Right. So at the end, a creature that looks like an elephant says thank you to Allura. And he says, it'll take time before we've completely rebuilt, but thanks to Voltron and the kind people of the Coalition, we will survive and one day thrive.
Woohoo!
So later in the Castle of Lions, Allura's thinking about their mission to free the universe from the Galra, and she's thinking they should use the information that they've gained. Now, when she says that, do you think she's talking about the information that Lotor gave them?
Oh, you're spoiling, dude.
No, but I mean, this is, you know, we've seen the show.
Yes, we've seen the show. And so basically every time we hear information in Volume 3, it's in bold print.
Yeah.
So To me, that is meant to be a signal to the reader. This is the same information source. So the information bold print that helped them free Pinto Santos is from the same source as the information bold print that will help them to liberate the people of Sprawl.
Right.
And so I guess let's go ahead and spoil it. Thanks a lot, man. I'm kidding. But yeah, at the end of volume three, it turns out that the source of this information, bold print, has been Lotor.
Right.
And so this is between seasons four and five, where if you recall, Lotor basically saved Keith from certain death. He was about to sacrifice himself to save a bunch of planets. Lotor sweeps in, saves the day, and said, I think it's time we have a conversation. And then at the beginning of season five, he's in a high security cell in the Castle of Lions, and the Paladins aren't sure whether to trust him. And so this is meant to sort of provide a bridge to motivate the Paladins to leverage the information that Lotor has. And at the beginning of season five, we see the Paladins already acting on that information. This is a narrative that leads to their decision to use that information more.
So Allura decides we're going to Sprawl and we're going to free those planets.
Yep.
And then you get all issues 2 through 5 dealing with that.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go quickly through this issue 2, because the biggest part of issue 2 really is that they come up to this, I don't know what you want to call it. It's like a nest.
Mm-hmm. They've made it out of a neutron star.
Right.
There are these creatures that have built a nest from material that they can pull from a neutron star. And the Paladins need some of the material from a neutron star to build some widget that they're going to use to physically free the planets of Sprawl from something that the Paladins describe as a tether.
Right.
And I got to tell you, I was really confused about this whole tether thing, because I feel like as much as we sometimes in the show and comic get bombarded with techno jargon.
Yeah.
I really feel like they left it really vague as to what this tether thing actually is.
Right. Apparently there were these birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
That when they flew near the nest, they weren't affected by the gravity.
Right.
Okay. But Voltron and the Lions were, right?
Yep.
So they decided that they're going to try to use the birds to defy the gravity.
Yeah, they basically hitch a ride on the birds.
Yeah.
On one of the birds.
Right. So they get that and they say, let's go home. They get back to the Castle of Lions.
And now that they have this ore, the next step in their plan is to take down the shield that surrounds Sprawl. And they say that they're going to have to, for whatever reason, they need to wipe Pidge's brain and send her to infiltrate the Galra base. Because apparently they do mind scanning and stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't want the Galra to find out that Pidge is a Paladin.
So they need to pass through a mental scanner.
Yeah.
Okay. And the only way they think they can do that is if Pidge loses her mind.
Yes.
So what we find out is what they really did was basically wipe Pidge's mind.
Yep.
So she doesn't know who she is in this.
Yes. And that's getting us into issue 3.
Right. And the first time you see her, she says, there doesn't appear to be any way out of here. Excuse me, I don't remember who I am. Can you help? You know, and you see this stuff and, of course, you realize, oh, she must have had her memory erased. So she goes, so what do I know? The card opens the door. I understand language, but can't remember who I am. It appears I need to figure out who I am and why I'm trapped in here. And this is what they're counting on. This is their plan.
Mm-hmm.
That they're counting on her figuring out who she is, what she's doing there, and how to get out of there, and what her plan is for bringing down the shield.
Yeah, I will say that one thing that's kind of fun is that back in Volume 1, you know, we had these text blocks that were meant to indicate Pidge thinking, you know, looking like a computer terminal. And what they have here is Pidge kind of comes to on the Galra base, and we have another one of those computer blurbs. It says, memory check failed. Deductive reasoning intact. Observation initiating. And the background, instead of being black, is kind of staticky. So it's kind of fun that they've at least gone back to what they had established in Volume 1 as the little means of showing Pidge's brain in action. But they're showing visually, even with the text, the computer font and the static background that she's not quite all there.
I like there's a funny exchange where Shiro and Lance are together and they're fighting off some of the sentries, mm-hmm. the Galver sentries.
Yeah.
And Lance says, okay, hear me out. You have to admit the Voltron show was working. Maybe we should do a revival. Shiro says, no. And Lance goes, aw, come on. Why not? Fans would love it. Shiro says, we need to focus on being paladins of Voltron, Lance. And Lance says, what about Keith? He took off and left us. Shiro says, Lance, we can't lose you too. You're too important. And Lance says, aw, you're saying Keith isn't important? Wait, are you just saying that to shut me up? Shiro goes, maybe. And meanwhile, he's like standing on a pile of Galra sentries that they defeated.
Yeah, that's a fun
bit. And he smiles.
That's a fun moment.
Yeah. I like that exchange.
And so, you know, we're going through all this plot stuff, but there are some really fun character moments throughout each of these comics. And that's a really good one.
Yeah. And then when we see Pidge again, she realizes that she had left herself a clue. And there were like all these connected triangles and stuff like that that were on her arm.
Mm-hmm. She sort of written on her own arm.
And she tries to figure out the code. And then, oh, okay. So I'm on a mission to help my friends. Then she says, according to this, to help my friends, I need to go to the core and deactivate. Where's the rest? Oh, the other arm. And she looks at the other arm. And you had mentioned this when we were talking to Mitch. She sweat through the ink on her other arm. So now she doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, and this goes back to season one where, you know, this is back when Allura is trying to get Pidge to confess that she's holding a secret. You know, this is before Pidge officially reveals to everyone that she's a girl. Allura's trying to get that secret out of Pidge. And Pidge, you know, she basically, Pidge gets this invitation to tell secrets or tell about herself. So she says, you know, I like peanuts, don't like peanut butter, blah, 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 and says, oh, I sweat a lot. And this comic kind of follows up on that point, which is kind of fun.
All right. So in the meantime, she's trying to avoid some sentry guards and everything and find out where she is and where the core is and how to avoid more people like that guy. Meanwhile, we go back and we see Shiro and Lance again. They're still fighting their way through. I think they get near the hangar. Is that true?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And then at another point on the planet, Allura and Hunker are fighting together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're near one of the, what, the ground cannons?
Yeah.
So they're trying to save a bunch of people and deliver them to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, Galra fighters are coming, so they gotta move. Shiro and Lance were able to get onto one of the ships in the hangar.
Mm-hmm.
And then they find Sprawl up ahead, but the shield is still up. So they're still counting on Pidge. So we go back to Pidge, and she finds herself in a room with a bunch of sentries. She says, I need to deactivate that shield, but I can't do that with them in the way. Coordinating a plan, but I don't have much time. I guess she ends up knocking into one of them from behind. That ends up making the sentry fire on another one, and they end up shooting each other, basically.
Yeah.
And she got rid of those guys. Now she just needs to figure out how to turn this shield off.
Right, and while she's figuring that out, Shiro and Lance are getting closer and closer to the shield, and it seems like all hope is lost here. And what's kind of fun here is there's another little bit between Shiro and Lance where Shiro says she's spewing smoke, talking about their ship. Lance says, I'm going outside. Shiro says, Lance, if anything happens, it's been an honor flying with you. You're the only thing cooler than space. And Lance says, I know.
Yeah.
Which is fun.
Both groups, Hunk and Allura and Shiro and Lance, are really counting on Pidge get cracking this code and deactivating the shield. And then while Allura and Hunk are talking to each other, Allura says, Hunk, I'm sorry I pressured us into doing such a dangerous mission. My desire to free the innocent and stop the Galra may have gone too far. And Hunk says, no, Allura, you were right. This is what being a paladin's all about. Thank you. And then they hear blamp, 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 and then they say, the shield is down. Let's use this cannon.
Yeah, the shield goes down. Shiro Lance's ship with Lance outside. He's got his his body outside the ship for a reason that is not entirely clear in this issue.
Right. It's not.
He's sticking on the ship. The shield is down. They're being pursued by Galra fighters. Allura and Hunk fire the cannon, which takes out the pursuing Galra ships. But in the ruckus, Lance falls off of the ship and is falling toward the planet below.
Right. And Shiro yells out, Lance is gone. Pidge is wondering what to do.
Yeah. And now we're getting into issue 4 here.
Right. The ship is still spewing smoke and Shiro's still in it. How did Shiro get out? Apparently, Shiro had, I guess, jumped onto another ship, and then he knocked out a few more sentries, and then he finally runs into Pidge.
Yes, and it's really not clear, looking at these panels, when Shiro jumped out of the ship.
Right.
You see the ship, it's falling, it's crashing, there's an explosion, and then you see this panel where Shiro is looking at the explosion, and says, hopefully the signal was loud enough for Pidge to hear. But we don't really see exactly where Shiro jumps out. It
right.
just sort of happens.
But Shiro runs into Pidge, and he has this thing that he said she has to put on. Once she puts it on, then she gets her memory back.
Yeah, it pretty quickly. And it causes headaches and all the rest of this stuff. Yeah, so it's kind of this massive load of information. And one of the funny things that she says is that her memories are beginning to come back because it's so painful. She says, so much information. Why did I have to be so smart?
And then she says, Lance, I remember Lance. Oh, no, poor Lance.
And Shiro says, you don't remember the plan yet, do you? And so it turns out Lance leaving the ship was intended.
Okay.
And Lance has got his Bayard long distance gun there. And start shooting at some Galra so that Shiro and Pidge can start the next phase of their plan.
Right. So at one point, he's pointing the gun. It's a long-range thing. He shoots at a Galra sentry.
Yeah, causes a big explosion, blows a bunch of sentries all over the place.
And then they say, great shooting, Lance. Let's begin the next phase. And we see Allura with, like, a pig-like creature.
Yeah. Yeah, this pig-like creature is a real boar. Get it?
So he tells Allura he's scared, and she goes, I know you're scared, but the Galra have you enslaved, and we're doing everything we can to free you. We may be able to do it without your help, but every soul that stands against the Galra weakens them. So you could be the difference between defeat and victory. I believe in you. And then the pig-like creature says, I will not let you or the other paladins down, princess. So she's inspiring those people. And then the Galra fleet arrives, and they're heading towards Lance's location. So Lance is out there flying on his own.
Yep, and it seems all hope is lost, but then the Castle of Lions shows up with some rebel ships.
Right. So, yay, Karan, he's helping out now with the castle ship.
Yep.
And then we see Red Lion come to rescue Lance.
Yep.
So Lance is back with Red Lion.
And the other paladins reunite with their lions. The rebel ships begin to engage the Galra fleet, allowing the lions to form Voltron and try to free the planets of Sprawl.
Yeah, this whole thing, when they're trying to free the planets of Sprawl and everything, they have something in the way here. It's this big slug-like creature.
Yeah.
They activate the tether and the dampeners, I guess, and they're ready to move the planets, right?
Yep.
But that slug-like thing is there. And this is the part where I told you before that I thought was funny.
Mm-hmm.
Hunk says, okay, I know I said I wanted to be thought of as the food guy, but right now I'm worried I'm going to be thought of as the guy who wet himself. And they're all looking at this thing, like, with big eyes, like they're all scared. And Lance says, you are the yellow paladin, but yeah, this is terrifying. But Karan gives this thing a name. He says, I didn't recognize it until it unfurled, but that's a Sorrow Spawn, one of the deadliest creatures in the universe. So, of course, the last thing that they have to fight in all of these issues, all of these volumes, is the most dangerous thing in the universe.
Of course.
And, of course, Allura says, we have to protect these planets. So how do you defeat this thing and protect the planets and free all these planets? How do you do that?
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, and along the way, as this creature is getting released, seemingly as the Paladins are using Voltron to cut this tether thing that we've been talking about, that really is not defined all that well, but it's like this energy field that is sort of binding the planets together in some way. And so Voltron's running around with what basically look like wire cutters, which is really kind of strange, I have to say.
Yes. This was one of the strangest things I had seen in the whole thing. It's Voltron using tools.
Yeah, and so it's cutting all these energy bands or something that are in some undescribed way holding these planets together. And as it's snip, snip, snipping all these energy strands or threads or tethers or whatever, this gigantic creature gets released. And, yes, it's the worst thing in the universe. And now it's a cliffhanger for chapter five or issue five.
Right, and Karan gives them the idea that they need to go inside the creature in order to beat the creature. So they go inside, and Pidge is doing some kind of a sonic scan, pinging their locations and cross-referencing the data, estimating routes are being calculated, and they're at the same time they're trying not to be digested while they're inside.
Yeah, and there are references made to Hunk and Keith having been in the Weblin before. So
Right.
they do acknowledge that at least some of them have been inside of a giant thing before.
Yeah. And then from the outside, Matt and the rebels and Karan, they're all trying to keep it from getting too close to any of the planets. So within the inside.
So the lions are in there trying to fight all these antibodies and all these other thingamabobs in the monster. Shiro has one of those, "It's been an honor flying with one of all of you" moments. And then all of a sudden, all of them feel this urge to form Voltron. So inside the creature, the lions are in different locations. And so they got the Voltron feeling. They form Voltron, and seemingly the lions coming together from different parts of the inside of the creature, forming the robot inside the creature, destroys the creature just before it can begin to eat one of the planets in the sprawl. And there you go.
So at one point they thought they were going to be sacrificing themselves, but then they ended up actually saving themselves.
And then here's where it gets really weird. So, in the last issue, Voltron's running around with giant wire cutters with neutron star ore to be able to cut this tether, whatever the heck it is. There are still enough bands of this tether that, they've got to do something to get these planets to a safe place. So Voltron basically grabs one of the tethers and flies toward a nearby star, dragging the planets with it, and then it basically throws all the planets toward the star, and all the planets somehow are freed from the tethers that remain and orbit the star in a ring.
In a ring, yes.
Yeah, a single orbital pattern. All these planets of different sizes. Some of these planets have moons. All of these planets are inhabited. And now they have this orbit that is somehow good for all of these planets and all the people on them to live happy lives. So I'm thinking of this moment, I gotta tell you, reminds me of is it Superman 2? Where all hope is lost, Lois Lane is dead, blah 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 blah. Clark Kent as Superman, he freaks out and flies around the planet backward a bunch of times, turning back time. Just enough to save the day, save Lois, and all that other good stuff. And then, of course, he sets the planet back in forward motion again. Because we all know that turning a planet in the opposite direction reverses time. Somehow, even though Voltron used those wire cutters to cut a bunch of the tethers, there's some left. Voltron somehow is able to drag many planets, throw them around the star. They occupy a really nice shared orbit that is good for all these planets of different sizes with different kinds of life forms, presumably. And oh, yeah, the tethers went away too, somehow. There you go.
And then after all said and done, it ended up that Bebo-B was filming the whole thing, the whole heroism and freeing the planets. And of course, it was a ratings juggernaut. So the people were watching the heroes instead of the cowards like Dutarn. And Lance says, so we've helped free these people, left them somewhere safe, and inspired the masses. Now what? And Alora says, the universe is safer because of the information Lotor provided us. It seems we might be able to trust him. It is time to use even more of his information and finally put an end to the Galra Empire.
And that's the end.
So if you only read all of the volumes of Voltron Legendary Defender comics, you would think, well, at the end, Lotor and the Paladins are friends.
Right.
And they defeat the Galra together.
Yeah, but if you'd only read the comics, you wouldn't know who Lotor is. So that's right. it wouldn't make much sense. You know, I really enjoyed the first two volumes. I think volume three works, but the whole tether thing is never explained very well.
It's science and magic together, right?
Yeah. In issue one, they're talking, Allura's talking about the threats that they face as they go into Sprawl. She mentions the shield that Pidge has to take down and all this other stuff. But the tether is not really directly referenced until they start trying to figure out a way to cut it. And so it just sort of gets thrown in. It's not really introduced early enough mm-hmm. as something they're going to have to do to get around. You know, in volume two, there's all this discussion about, well, you got to get through the wastes and this long stretch of this and a long stretch of that. At least the stuff is outlined early on, so we have some idea of what the map is. But here, the tether thing really kind of feels like it comes out of left field. And running around seeing Voltron with this gigantic hand tool and then throwing planets around an arbitrary star into this orbit that really just somehow works really is hard to grasp, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, the good thing is that all of our characters were pretty much who they are throughout the whole thing. I mean, we had Lance being his sharpshooter self. He was also, you know, funny in areas with Hunk and other things. Pidge being her smart self and being able to figure out even when she didn't have her memory.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Alora being as great as she is and wanting to help all the coalition, you know, help all the enslaved planets and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, just everybody was their true selves in this one.
Yeah,
and of course there was no Keith in this one.
Right. But I mean, the characterizations, like you said, are spot on. The dialogue is spot on. I mean, these characters look like they should. They sound like they should. You can imagine the voice actors saying these lines.
Yep.
And them feeling authentic. I mean, the characterizations are there. I just think this whole tether thing is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, and now that I think going back and looking at all three volumes, I can see why they did the motion comics with the first one, but I really think they would have ran into a little bit of problems trying to figure out how to do volume two and volume three with all that, a lot of that crazy space stuff and monsters and just trying to figure out how all that kind of stuff could actually happen. It would have been pretty difficult to do with motion comics.
Yeah. Yeah. They might have been. I think they could have pulled it off. But yeah, I was really thrown by the whole tether thing and the wire cutters. I mean, yes, Voltron has a sword. It's a gigantic sword and a gigantic cannon on its arm and all that other stuff. But wire cutters, really? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a good ride.
It was. It really was. I still enjoyed the comics all the way through. The first three volumes the only three volumes, sadly, were a lot of fun. Just a fun, different take on Voltron.
Right. So we're talking about a total of 15 issues that came down to three trade paperback volumes.
Right. And you can still find the comics in digital form on your favorite e-comics sites such as Comixology and of course you can still find them in print form if you search online. The trade paperbacks are still available at some outlets, so check them out.
Like the Voltron store,
yes,
and Amazon.com and other places like yep. that.
So if you need some more Voltron in your life, some more Voltron Legendary Defender in your life, the comics are there. Check them out.
And it's only about $14.99 a volume.
Yeah, so it's not horrible.
Nope. So I want to thank you guys for joining us for this review of the Voltron comics from Lion Forge Comics. So thank you for joining us, and we'll see you all next time on
Let's Voltron.